I say. My defense secretary basically read from the same script. He told them we were testing new technology independent of our continental systems. He didn't mention the virus, but if China's behind it, they got the message.
They're probably concerned about what Pyongyang is thinking.
Yes, we can expect more fire and brimstone language from the North Korean dictator. Noya grips my arm.
If it's any consolation, I would not do anything differently from what you've done. You've fortified your military capabilities. You've demonstrated those fortified capabilities for all the world to see. You've issued an ultimatum to Volkov, and you've assembled the best minds you can possibly gather together to stop this virus.
You have no idea how consoling that is, I say as we turn and begin the walk up the path toward the cabin.
Then believe in the plan, she says.
We approach the black tent in the backyard where the Russian security detail remains standing at attention. Then the men step back, and Prime Minister Volkov emerges from the tent, fixing his tie, nodding at his men. If he leaves now, I whisper to Noya, we'll have the answer to our question.
He'll make an excuse. He'll say he's leaving to protest your military exercises off their border.
Right. But the stated reason won't matter. If the Russians leave now, after the threat I've issued, there will be no doubt that they're behind this. Volkov turns and sees us approach.
Mr. President, Madam Prime Minister.
Seeing Noya for the first time, he greets her with a handshake, all formality. Then he looks at me. I don't say anything. It's his move.
President Chernikov assures you, Mr. President, that Russia remains committed to helping you prevent this horrific virus from detonating. He gestures to the cabin. Shall we head inside? He says.
Chapter 64 Plan B. This is it. Her last job. Her last kill. And then she will be done, wealthy and free to raise her unborn daughter somewhere far away from all this. Her daughter will know love. She will know happiness. War and violence will be something she reads about in books or hears about on the news. She checks her watch. It's almost time. She squints up at the afternoon sun. The morning sickness is there, as always, aggravated by the gentle rocking of the boat on the lake, but her adrenaline overwhelms it. She has no time for nausea right now. She glances over at the other team members on the boat, ridiculous as they look with their hats and fishing poles. They've kept their distance after she killed two of their comrades. That's fine with her. In all likelihood, their role in the mission is over now anyway, other than giving her a ride. She may need to reconsider her opinion of men now. Studies say that children with two parents are happier, healthier, more well-adjusted. So maybe she'll marry. It's hard to imagine. She's simply never felt the need for a man. Sex? Sex to her was a price to be paid. A price to be paid by her mother to the Serbian soldiers for allowing her and her two children to remain in their home after they killed her father, officially because she was Christian, not Muslim like her husband, but in reality because of her beauty and willingness, for her children's sake, to satisfy the soldiers' needs on demand on a nightly basis. Sex was the price Bach paid for the bread and rice she would steal in the marketplace on those evenings when she couldn't escape the soldiers' ambush. Sex was the price to be paid to get close to Ranko, the Serbian soldier who agreed to teach her how to fire a rifle from long range. And, of course, it was the price to be paid for having a child of her own. The man who impregnated her, Jeffrey, was a good man, a man she chose deliberately for that purpose after careful research. Brains, a radiologist who studied here in the States at Yale. Musical ability, played the cello. Athletic, played rugby in college. Handsome, with good bone structure. No history of cancer or mental illness in his immediate family. His parents were still alive in their 80s. She slept with him no more than 3 times a week to maximize his potency. She stuck around until she got a positive test result, then left Melbourne without another word. He never knew her real name.
"It's time,"
says one of the men, tapping his watch. Bach hikes the oxygen tank onto her back, piles on her other bag, slings her rifle, Anna Magdalena, protected in its case, over her shoulder. She puts on the mask, adjusts it, and nods at the rest of her team, giving each of them one last look. When this is over, she wonders, will they in fact transport her back to the extraction point? Or will they try to kill her once she's performed the mission, once she is no longer useful to them? The latter, probably. Something she will deal with when the time comes. She falls backward off the boat, into the lake water.
Chapter 65. Inside the communications room, I am talking to my CIA director, Erica Beatty. Danny always calls her Spooky, not as a pun on her career-long allegiance to the agency, but because of her poker-faced demeanor and the dark circles under her hooded eyes. "I know she's seen and done a lot," he has said, "and who knows what the East Germans really did to her in captivity, but damn, I can't shake the image of her brewing potions in a boiling cauldron inside her gingerbread house. Spooky, yes, but she's my spook. And she knows more about Russia than anyone with a pulse. She's also one of the 6 people who could have leaked Dark Ages." "So what does he do, Erica?" She nods her head, digesting everything I've told her.
"Mr. President, this is not Chernikov style," she says. "He is ruthless, yes, but not reckless. Of course he would be interested in causing great damage to our country, but the risk is too high. If Russia is implicated in this, he knows we will retaliate with great force. I don't see him taking this chance."
"But answer my question," I say. "If he is behind this virus, and now he sees that we have restored our military capabilities, what does he do?"
"He abandons his plan," she says. "The risk is far greater to him now, because no matter how paralyzed we might be at home, we could still strike him. But, Mr. President, I do not see Russian fingerprints on this."
My phone buzzes. "See Brock. I have to run, Erica." "Are you near the computer?" Carolyn asks when I answer the phone. Moments later, my computer screen is split between Carolyn Brock at the White House and a video currently frozen on an image of Tony Winters, the host of Meet the Press, his hair expertly coiffed, his tie knotted perfectly, his hands raised and mouth pursed in mid-speech. "They completed it a half hour ago," says Carolyn. "They're going to start running excerpts this morning. Full interview runs tomorrow morning." I nod. The video starts to play. Winters caught in mid-sentence. "Overnight reports that the president is missing, that not even his aides know where he is. Madam Vice President, is the president missing?" Kathy nods, as if expecting the question, her expression somber. I'd have expected mirth, as in, what a ridiculous question. She raises a hand and brings it down like a hatchet.
"Tony, the president is working day and night for the people of this country to bring back jobs, to keep America safe, to provide tax relief to the middle class.
But has he gone missing? Tony, do you know where he is?" She smiles politely. Finally,
"Tony, I don't keep tabs on the President of the United States, but I can only assume that he is surrounded by aides and Secret Service at all times."
"The reports say even his aides don't know where he is." She opens her hands.
"I'm not going to respond to speculation.
Reports suggest that the President is getting away from Washington and preparing for his testimony this week before the House Select Committee. Others suggest that his blood disease has flared up again and he's in treatment." The Vice President shakes her head.
"Here," says Carolyn, "right here."
"Tony," says Kathy, "I'm sure his critics would love to paint the picture of a president having a nervous breakdown, hiding under his covers, or fleeing the Capitol in a panic, but that's not the case.
Whether I know his precise whereabouts at this moment or not, I know that he is in full control of the government. And that's all I'm going to say on the topic.
The clip ends. I sit back in my chair. Carolyn explodes. His critics would love to paint the picture of a nervous breakdown and hiding under his covers, fleeing in panic. She just painted that picture. A nervous breakdown? Are you kidding me? This is why you called me, I ask.
That soundbite will run all day. Everyone's going to pick it up. The Sunday papers will lead with it.
I don't care.
None of those overnight reports said anything about a nervous breakdown or fleeing in...
Carrie?
Mr. President, this was calculated. She's no rookie. She knew she was going to be asked the question. She had that response.
Carrie, I get it, okay? She did it on purpose. She stabbed me in the back. She's distancing herself from me. I don't care. Do you hear me? I don't care.
We have to respond. It's a problem.
There's only one problem right now, Carrie. Have you heard? It's the one that might bring our country to its knees any minute now.
We have.
I look at my watch. It's just past 2 p.m. About 10 hours before Saturday in America comes to an end, and any time between now and then, our country could go up in flames. So as much as I appreciate your loyalty, keep your eyes on the prize. Got it?
Carolyn bows her head, chastened.
Yes, sir. I apologize. And I'm sorry I let her leave the operations center. She refused to listen. I couldn't very well order Secret Service to detain her.
I breathe out, try to calm down. That's on her, not you.
Politics aside, is Kathy's disloyalty significant? Kathy is, after all, one of the six people I haven't ruled out of suspicion.
If I died last night, she'd be president right now.
Carrie, get a hold of her, I say. Tell her I want her back in the operations center in the sub-basement. Tell her that when she gets there, I'll call her.
Chapter 66. Bach positions herself on the sea craft, gripping the arms, much as a child would hold a kickboard when learning to swim. Except those kickboards aren't propelled by twin jet thrusters. She pushes the green button on the left arm and aims the vehicle downward, plunging below the surface of the lake until she evens out at 30 feet below the surface. She pushes the button to accelerate the thrusters until she's moving at 10 kilometers per hour through the murky water. She has a fair distance to travel. She is at the eastern end of this huge body of water.
Boat to your north, says the voice in her earbud. Veer south. Left. Veer left.
She sees the boat on the surface of the water, but not before her team did, with their GPS and radar capabilities on the boat. She veers left, thrusting through the foggy green water, the weeds and fish. The GPS on her console shows her the destination with a blinking green dot, and the number below ticks off her distance. 1,800 meters. 1,500 meters.
Water skier from the right. Hold. Hold.
She sees the boat above her, to her right, its engine chopping at the water, followed by the skimming of the water by the skier. She doesn't stop. She's well below them. She guns the watercraft and speeds past them, beneath them. She'll have to get herself one of these toys. 1,100 meters. She slows the watercraft. The lake bottoms out at 50 meters at its deepest, but as she gets close to shore, the land rises up sharply to the water, and the last thing she needs is to slam into the earth.
Hold. Hold. Stay down. Stay down. Sentry. Sentry.
She comes to an abrupt halt 900 meters from the shore and doesn't move in the water, nearly losing her grip on the watercraft, allowing herself to drift lower in the lake. A member of the security detail, U.S. Secret Service or the Germans or Israelis, must be in the woods near the shore looking around. There can't be very many of them patrolling the woods. It would require hundreds of people to secure more than 1,000 acres of heavy woods, and their security details are light.
Last night, of course, the agents walked the entire acreage, swept it thoroughly before the president arrived. But now they can't afford to patrol the woods. Most of the security will be around or inside the cabin, with a few at the dock and a few in the backyard where the woods end.
All clear,
the voice finally says. She gives it another minute for good measure, then proceeds onward. When she's 300 meters from shore, she kills the engine entirely. She rides the momentum of this fun little toy upward until she's coasting on top of the water, much like someone riding a surfboard to shore. She stays low as she can, with an air tank, her rifle, and a bag tied to her back, until she beaches on the small clip of sand. She removes the scuba mask and breathes fresh air. She glances around and sees nobody. This part of the lake bends around so that she is entirely out of the sight line of anyone by the dock. The Secret Service cannot possibly see her. She climbs up onto the land and finds the spot where she is to hide the watercraft and scuba gear. She does so quickly, stripping off the gear and throwing on clean, dry fatigues from her bag. She towel-dries her hair and makes sure her face and neck are free of any moisture before she applies the camouflage paint. She uncases her rifle and slings it over her shoulder, checks her sidearm. She is ready to do this now, alone, as she prefers it, as she's always been. Chapter 67. The woods provide Bach excellent cover. The tall, lush canopy trees block most of the sunlight, which renders visibility difficult for two reasons: the darkness itself, and the intermittent strips of sunlight penetrating the canopy, which play tricks on the eyes. It's hard to see much of anything in here. She finds herself back in the Trebevich mountainside, on the run, in hiding, after it was over. After she turned the tables on the sniper, Ranko, the red-headed Serbian soldier who, for pity or sex or both, had taught her how to fire a rifle.
"Here, again, you're using your arms too much," Ranko said, as they sat up in the bombed-out nightclub that served as a sniper's hideaway in the mountains. "I do not understand you, girl. One day you can shoot a bottle of beer off a tree stump from 100 meters away, and today your mechanics are those of a beginner? Let me show you once more."
Taking the gun from her, settling into the perch.
"Hold steady, like this," he said,
his last words before she stuck the kitchen knife into his neck. Taking his rifle, on which she was now well-trained, to the open window of the nightclub overlooking Sarajevo, aiming down at Ranko's comrades, the patrolling Serbian soldiers who had beaten her father to death and carved a cross in his chest, all for the crime of being Muslim. Pop, 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 pop! Firing the rifle in rapid succession, picking them off one after the other, having to leave the last one as he dropped his weapon and sprinted toward the trees. She hid in the mountains for more than a week afterward, hungry and thirsty and cold, moving about constantly, afraid to stay in the same spot, as they hunted for the young girl who killed 6 Serbian soldiers, one of them up close, and the others from 100 meters away. With the pack and rifle on her back, she moves forward gingerly. With each step, she plants her foot before shifting weight onto it. To her right, something jumps, and her heart skips a beat as she reaches for her sidearm. Some little animal, a rabbit or squirrel, gone before she can make it out. She waits for the adrenaline to drain.
2 kilometers due north,
they tell her in her earbud. She continues her gentle, quiet movements forward. Her instinct is to move quickly to her spot, but discipline is essential. She doesn't know these woods. She never scouted the location as she'd normally prefer. The ground is dark and uneven, obscured by the brush and lack of light, full of tree roots and branches and who knows what else. Foot forward, weight forward, stop, and listen. Foot forward, weight forward, stop, and listen. Foot forward,
wait for... Movement. Up ahead, appearing from around a tree. The animal is no bigger than a large dog, with thick salt-and-pepper fur, tall ears perked at attention, a long snout, and beady black eyes that focus on her. There aren't supposed to be any wolves around here. A coyote? Must be. A coyote that is standing between her and her destination. Another one now. A second one, popping its head up farther down, about the same size. A third one, a bit smaller and darker in color, separating itself from the others, moving to box left, eyes on her, something fleshy dripping from its mouth. A fourth one to her right, a semicircle of four in what she can only assume is some kind of formation. A defensive formation, or an attack formation. The latter, she decides. Eight beady eyes on her. She takes a step forward and hears a low growl, sees the sides of the first animal's long snout tremble, revealing teeth, presumably jagged fangs, that she's too far away to make out. The others, spurred on by their leader, join in, snarling and growling. Are they coyotes? They're supposed to be afraid of humans. Food, she thinks. They must be close to food or already feasting, maybe something big and tasty like a deer carcass. They must see her as a threat to their lunch. Unless they see her as the lunch. She doesn't have time for this. It would be too risky and time-consuming to alter her path. One side is going to have to move, and it isn't going to be hers. Her body otherwise still, she removes her sidearm. Her Sig Sauer with the long suppressor. The lead animal lowers its head, the growling louder, snapping at her. She aims her weapon at the small space between its eyes. Then she adjusts her aim for its ear and fires once, a single suppressed thwip. The animal yelps and spins around, bounding away in a flash, nothing worse than a small flesh wound on the tip of its ear. The others disappear just like that, too. It might have been a problem if they'd all attacked at once, coming from different directions. She would have taken them all out, but it would have required more ammunition and probably made more noise. It's always easier just to take out the leader. If there is nothing else to learn from history, it's that from humans to animals, from the most primitive to the most civilized, most individuals want to be led. Take out the leader, and the rest of the pack panics.
Chapter 68. It would be better if it came from you, I say to Chancellor Richter, as we confer in the room I would call the cabin's family room. The other leaders in the European Union look to you, Mr. Chancellor. That's no secret. Yes, well... Richter places his coffee cup on its saucer, searches for a place to set it down, buying himself a moment to think. It never hurts to stroke the boundless ego of the Chancellor, the longest-serving leader in the EU and, my flattery aside, increasingly the most influential. Never mind the fact that if the virus activates and decisions of war must be made, I will be making the same phone calls, with more or less the same pleas to the leaders of France, the UK, Spain, Italy, and the other NATO countries. If we have to invoke Article 5 of the NATO Treaty and go to war with Russia or whatever country is behind this, I'd rather the motion to invoke came from someone other than the United States. Better yet, as was the case after 9/11, a motion joined by all NATO members. It would be better if it looked like an unsolicited decision rather than a plea from a wounded superpower. He doesn't answer right away. I didn't expect him to. Still, it is the first time I've seen Jürgen Richter at a loss for words. In the background, from the corner, the television plays a continuous string of bad news. The water supply difficulties in Los Angeles, possibly caused by terrorism. North Korea vowing another ballistic missile test after our military exercises in Japan. The civil unrest in Honduras, where half the president's cabinet has resigned. Further developments in the assassination plot against the Saudi king.
But the lead story, of course, is the upcoming testimony of the President of the United States before the House Select Committee and, courtesy of my Vice President, the question of whether the President is suffering from a nervous breakdown or has fled the Capitol in a panic. My phone buzzes, FBI Liz, saving the Chancellor from that awkward silence. "Excuse me," I say. I tap my earbud as I stand in the kitchen, looking out over the backyard, the black tent, and the wall of endless trees beyond. "Go ahead, Liz," I say. "The team members that the Secret Service killed on the bridge," says the acting FBI Director Elizabeth Greenfield. "We've identified them." "And?" "They are part of a group called Brett Nisi. It means warriors, basically. They're mercenaries. They come from all over the world, and they fought all over the world. The narcos used them in Colombia. They fought for the rebels in Sudan until the government hired them to switch sides. They fought for the Tunisian government against the ISIS insurgency there. It's what we figured. Cutouts. Untraceable. But Red Nisi doesn't work for free. They're soldiers, not ideologues. Somebody paid them, and for something like this, Mr. President, you can only imagine how much money they demand." "That's right," I say. "Good. You're going to follow the money." "We're trying, sir. It's our best lead."
"Keep at it, as fast as you can," I say as the door leading to the basement opens behind me. Up walk the Americans on our tech team, Devin Whitmer and Casey Alvarez, a wave of cigarette smoke wafting off them. I don't know them to be smokers, but I assume some of the Europeans are. Devin is no longer wearing his sport jacket. His shirt has come partially untucked, and his sleeves are rolled up. The wear on his face is evident. But he has a smile on his face. Some of Casey's ponytail is undone. She removes her glasses and rubs her eyes, but the upturn of her mouth is promising. I feel something flutter through my chest.
"We've located it, Mr. President," says Devin. "We found the virus."
Chapter 69. Foot forward, weight forward, stop and listen. Foot forward, weight forward, stop and listen. It worked for her when foraging for food in the markets of Sarajevo. It worked for her when hiding from the Serbian army in the mountainside as they searched for the half-Muslim Bosnian girl who killed six of their men. It worked for her a week later when she finally summoned the courage to sneak down from the mountains to her home. A home that had burned to the ground. A two-story house, now little more than a heap of gray ash and rubble. Next to it, her mother's naked body tied to a tree, her throat slashed open. 2 kilometers. Bach could run the distance in 12 minutes, even with this pack on her back. She could walk it in 20. But it takes her almost 40 minutes in this cautious, plodding fashion. Along the way, little animals bounce out of her path, even a few deer freezing in place on her approach, then bounding away. But no more coyotes, or whatever they were. Maybe word got out not to mess with the girl with the gun. She hasn't strayed far from the east side of the acreage, heading due north during her jaunt and sticking close to the lake's shoreline. The patrols aren't likely to come from that side, but rather from the north, south, or west. She reaches the tree, the thickest one she's seen in these woods. 60 feet high and 2 feet in diameter, she was told, which to her means about 18 meters high and 60 centimeters wide. Tall and skinny. This is where it will happen. This is where she will kill him. Above her, the tree is thick with leaves and strong branches, easy to climb. But from the ground, there is nothing to latch onto. Full climbing gear, a lanyard, foot spikes, would be too cumbersome, too heavy to transport. From her bag, she removes the cord of rope with a noose on one end. She throws it up over the lowest hanging branch, a good 4 meters above ground, about 13 feet high. It takes her 3 tries to get the noose end over the branch. Then she raises up the other side of the rope as the noose side lowers down to her. Once she has it in her hand, she slides the straight end of the rope through the noose. Then she pulls down on the straight end slowly, careful to avoid any snags, as the noose end slowly rises again. On the branch, the two sides come together in a knot. She puts on the backpack again and the rifle and grips the rope. She'll need to do this fast. It's a lot of weight to put on the branch, so the less time it takes, the better. She takes a breath. Her nausea has subsided, but she is bone-tired, weary, and shaky. She fantasizes about sleep, about stretching out her legs and closing her eyes. Her team may have had a point about her going it alone. They wanted to deploy a force of 10 or 12 in the woods. That would have been fine with her, but the risk was too great. She couldn't know how heavy the patrols of the woods would be. It was hard enough for her to make it to her spot alone without incident. Multiply one person by 12, and that's a dozen different opportunities for detection. It would only take one mistake, one person who was too loud or clumsy, and the entire operation would be blown. She looks around one more time, seeing nothing, hearing nothing. She climbs the rope, inching upward, her arms straining, one hand over the other, legs scissored over the rope. She's just reaching for the branch when she hears it. A noise in the distance. Not the sound of small animals scurrying away. Not the low growl or angry bark of a predator. Human voices coming her way. It's a burst of laughter she first hears, then animated chatter muted by distance. Does she drop down and remove her sidearm? The rope would still be visible, dangling from a branch. The voices get closer. More laughter. She removes her feet from the rope and puts them taut against the tree to steady herself, feeling the strain of the branch. If she holds completely still, they may never see her. Movement draws the eye more than anything else, more than color or sound. Still, if the tree branch snaps, the noise will be unmistakable. She holds still, no small chore when suspended in the air, her arms straining, sweat dripping into her eyes. She sees them now, two of them, through the trees to the west, semi-automatic weapons in their hands, their voices growing louder. Her right hand lets go of the rope, moving to the grip of her sidearm. She can't dangle here forever. The branch won't hold. And sooner or later, the one arm holding her up will give out too. She manages to pull her sidearm free. They draw closer, not specifically walking in her direction, more of a southeasterly direction, but getting near. If she can see them, they can see her. Trying to obscure the movement of the weapon, she holds it close to her side. She'll have to take out both of them before they can rattle off a single round, before they can reach their radios. And then she'll have to figure out what happens next.
Chapter 70. I check my watch, nearly 3 p.m. The virus could go off at any minute, but no later than 9 hours from now. And my people found the virus.
So, that's great, right?
I say to Devin and Casey, you found it.
Yes, sir. Great is the right word.
Casey pushes her glasses up against the bridge of her nose.
Thanks to Augie, we never would have located it ourselves. We tried for 2 weeks. We tried everything. We even did manual searches. We ran customized.
But now you found it.
Yes, she nods. So that's step one.
What's step two?
Neutralizing it. It's not like we can just hit a delete button and make it go away. And if we do it wrong, well, it's like a bomb. If you don't disable it properly, it goes off.
Right. Okay. I say, so... Devin says, so we're trying to recreate the virus on the other computers. Can Augie do that? Augie was the hacker, sir, remember? Nina was the code writer. Actually, if someone's been most helpful, it's the Russians. I cast a glance around me and lower my voice. Are they really helping, or just appearing to help? They could be taking you down the wrong road.
We've been on guard for that, says Casey, but it doesn't seem like they're misleading us. They've told us things we've never known about what they do. It seems like their orders were to do everything possible to help us.
I nod. That's certainly what I was aiming for. I can't know if it's true.
But they didn't write this code either, she adds. This virus Nina created. Augie says she created it 3 years ago. It's more advanced than anything we've ever seen. It's quite amazing.
We can give her a posthumous award for the best cyber terrorist ever when this is over, okay? Tell me what's going to happen. You're going to recreate the virus and then learn how to neutralize it, like a simulated war game?
Yes, sir.
And you have all the supplies you need?
I think we have enough laptops here, sir, and there are thousands at the Pentagon for the rest of the threat response team.
I had 100 computers shipped here for this very purpose. We have another 500 under Marine Guard at the airport, not 3 miles away.
And water, coffee, food, all that?
The last thing I need is for these experts to falter physically. They have enough pressure on them mentally.
Cigarettes? I say, waving my hand at the stench.
Yeah, we're fine. The Russians and Germans smoke up a storm. It's totally polluted down there, Devin makes a face. At least we got them to agree to smoke in the laundry room. There they can open a window.
They?
There's a window?
Yeah, in the laundry. Secret Service locked all the windows, I say, realizing, of course, that it doesn't stop someone from unlocking them from the inside.
I head down the stairs to the basement. Devin and Casey following me.
Mr. President, Alex calls out, following me down the stairs as well. I hit the bottom of the stairs and turn to the war room, moving quickly, feeling a ringing in my ears along with my doctor's words of warning. The war room is filled with desks and laptops, dozens more off to the side and a large white board. Other than the security camera in the corner of the room, it looks like an ordinary classroom. 6 people are here, 2 each from Russia, Germany, and Israel, chatting while they open laptops and bang away on keyboards.
No, Augie.
Check the laundry room, Alex, I say. I hear him moving behind me. I hear his words, too, from 2 rooms away.
Why is this window open?
It only takes Alex a minute to sweep the entire basement, including the room I've taken over as the communications room. I already know the answer before he tells me.
He's gone, Mr. President. Augie is gone.
Chapter 71. The 2 members of the security patrol are dark and burly, crew-cut and square-jawed and wide-bodied. Whatever they're saying to each other in German as they march toward her must be humorous. They'll stop laughing if either of them, moving southeast, turns his head to the left. Her head only inches from the branch above her, suspended in air by one hand on a rope, Bach feels her strength giving way. She blinks away the sweat in her eyes as her arm begins to tremble furiously. And she can hear the branch, with all her weight on one isolated part, start to give way, a steady creaking. Her bag and clothes may be camouflaged, her face and neck may be painted pine green to match the tree foliage, but if that branch even begins to crack, the game is over. If she shoots, she must end it right there, 2 quick shots. And then what? She could steal their radios, but it wouldn't take the rest of the team very long to realize that 2 of their sentries have gone missing. She'll have no choice but to abort. Abort. She's never dropped a job or failed one. She could do it now, yes, and probably expect retaliation from the people who hired her. But that's not the problem. She doesn't fear retaliation. 2 in the past, on jobs she carried out successfully, the people who hired her tried to kill her afterward to tie up loose ends, and she's still here. The people they sent are not. The problem now is Delilah. The name she will give her child, her mother's name. Delilah will not grow up with that burden. She will not know what her mother has done. She will not live in fear. She will not experience terror so great and long-lasting that it seeps into your pores, never leaves you, colors everything that comes afterward. The men move past her sightline for a moment, disappearing behind the tree from which she is hanging. When they pass by on the other side of the trees, she will be completely exposed, no more than 10 meters from them. If either of them looks to his left, due east, they won't miss her. They come into sight again on the other side of the tree, and they stop. The closer one has a mole on his cheek and a deformed ear that looks like it's taken some hits over the years. He drinks from a water bottle, his Adam's apple bobbing on his unshaved throat. The other man, smaller, is standing in the shadows of the woods, a beam of light shooting upward, scanning the trees, scanning the ground. Don't look to your left. But they will, of course. And there's no time. She can't hold on much longer. The branch groans out a larger creak. The first man lowers the water bottle, looks up, then turns to his left, toward her. Bach already has her sig aimed at the first man, a bead on the space between his eyes. A loud squawk comes from both radios at the same time, something in German, but by any measure indicating that something has gone wrong. Each man reaches for the radio on his waist. A few words are exchanged, and they turn and run north in headlong flight back toward the cabin. What just happened? She doesn't know. Doesn't care. With no time and no strength left, Bach puts the sidearm in her mouth, her teeth clamping down on the long suppressor. Her right hand free now, she swings it up and grabs the thickest part of the branch near the tree's body. Then her left hand comes off the rope and grabs the branch too, just quickly enough to avoid a free fall to the ground. With a groan that is far too loud, but not caring about the consequences now, she summons whatever energy she has left and does a pull-up, her face scraping against the branch. She pushes her feet against the base of the tree and runs them upward until she manages to get her left leg over the branch. Not the most graceful maneuver she's ever performed, but she is finally in an upright position, straddling the tree branch, almost losing her backpack and rifle in the process. She breathes out. Wipes her forehead, slick with sweat, camouflage paint be damned. She gives herself 1 minute. She counts aloud to 60, managing to reholster her sidearm, ignoring the burn in her arm, slowing her breathing. She unties the knot and pulls the loose rope up. She wraps it around her neck, unable at the moment to access the backpack. She's not going to spend another minute on this branch, even if she's sitting over the thickest part now. She steadies herself against the tree and gets to her feet, reaches for the next branch, and starts climbing. When she arrives at the top, she'll find a secure perch, and she'll be in perfect position to carry out her job without detection.
Chapter 72.
Cowboy's gone missing. Repeat, cowboy's gone missing. We need a full search of the woods. Alpha team, stay home.
Alex Trimble clicks off the radio and looks at me.
Mr. President, I'm sorry. This is my fault.
It was my idea to keep the security light, to keep this meeting secret. We had to, and what security we have has been devoted to watching for everyone trying to come in the cabin. We weren't worried about someone trying to leave. Just find him, Alex. On our way to the stairs, I pass Devin and Casey, ashen, as if they'd done something wrong. Both of them with their mouths open, trying to find words. Fix the problem, I say, pointing back to the war room. Figure out how to kill that virus. That's all that matters. Go. Alex and I head up the stairs and stand in the kitchen, looking out the window to the south, the expansive backyard, and then the woods that seem to have no end. Alex is giving instructions through his radio, but he will remain at my side. The agents are now scrambling, most of them moving into the woods, searching for Augie, but a small number of agents, the Alpha Team, hold back to secure the perimeter. I don't know how he got to the woods without being seen, but I do know that if Augie's in there, it will be very difficult for our small team of agents to find him. More important, why run? Alex, I say, about to express these thoughts, we should... But my words are interrupted by the noise from the woods. Unmistakable even from inside the cabin. The rat-tat-tat of gunfire from an automatic weapon.
Chapter 73. Mr. President!
I ignore Alex, bounding down the stairs and into the woods over uneven ground, turning sideways to pass between trees.
Mr. President, please!
I keep going through dark terrain shrouded by the tree canopy, hearing the shouts of men up ahead.
At least let me go in front of you, he says,
and I allow him to overtake me. Alex has his automatic weapon at the ready and is swiveling his head from side to side. When we reach the clearing, Augie is sitting on the ground, leaning against a tree, seizing his chest. Above him, the tree has been splintered to near devastation from bullets. Two Russian agents stand with their automatic weapons at their sides, while Jacobson is giving them an earful, stabbing the air with his finger. When Jacobson sees us, he stops and turns, showing us his palm in a stop gesture.
We're okay! Everyone's okay!
He glares one more time at the Russians, then approaches us. Our comrades from the Russian Federation saw him first, he says. They opened fire. They say they were just warning shots.
Warning shots? Who needed warning shots?
I walk toward the Russians, pointing back to the cabin. Go back to the cabin. Get out of my woods. Jacobson says something to them, a word or two in Russian. Their expressions implacable. They nod, turn, and leave us.
Thank God I was close, says Jacobson. I ordered them to cease fire.
Thank God you were close, as in, you think the Russians were trying to kill him? I ask. Jacobson ponders that, expelling air through his nose. He throws up a hand.
The Russian National Guard, they're supposed to be the best Russia has. If they wanted to kill him, he'd be dead.
President Chernikov recently created a new internal security force, answering directly to him. The word is that his National Guard is the elite of the elite.
How sure are you of that? I asked Jacobson.
Not sure at all, sir.
I pass between the Secret Service agents and walk over to Augie. I squat down next to him.
What the hell were you doing, Augie?
His lips quiver, his chest still heaves with deep breath, and his eyes are wide and unfocused.
They...
His throat chokes up. He swallows hard.
Tried to kill me.
I glance up at the tree above him. A quick glance reveals that the bullets that riddled the tree were about 5 feet off the ground. Doesn't feel like warning shots to me, but I suppose it depends on where he was standing.
Why'd you run, Augie?
A faint shake of the head and his eyes drift off.
I can't stop this. I can't be there when it...
You're scared, is that it? Augie, almost sheepishly, his body still shaking, nods.
Is that all this is?
Fear, remorse, feeling overwhelmed?
Or have I missed something about Augie?
Get up. I grab his arm and force him to his feet. This is no time for scared, Augie. Let's you and I have a talk in the cabin.
Chapter 74. Bach finally reaches the perch she's seeking high up in the white pines, her arms and back feeling the strain of climbing upward with a sizable bag and rifle on her back. In her earbuds, she listens to Wilhelm Friedemann Herzog performing his playful rendition of the violin concerto in E major 3 years ago in Budapest. Through the pines, she has a clear view of the cabin in the distance and the grounds to the south. The branches next to the trunk of the tree are thick enough to hold her. She straddles a branch and places her case in front of her. She opens it with her thumbprint and removes Anna Magdalena, assembling it in less than 2 minutes, looking out over the trees as she does so. She sees sentries patrolling the grounds, men with weapons. A black tent. 4 men climbing the stairs to the porch, moving quickly. She adjusts the scope feverishly. She has no time to create a platform and mount the rifle and get into position, instead bringing it to her shoulder and looking through the scope. Not ideal, and she will only have 1 chance at a shot before blowing her cover, blowing everything up so she can't make a mistake. She works forward to back as they approach the door to the cabin. A large, dark-haired man, earpiece. Shorter, lighter man, earpiece. The president, passing between the men, disappearing into the cabin. followed by a short man, frail, tangled dark hair. Is that him? Is it him? Yes. 1 second to decide. Take the shot.
Chapter 75. I take Augie by the arm and pull him into the cabin. Alex and Jacobson behind us step in and close the cabin door. I move Augie into the living room and put him on the couch. Get him some water, I tell Alex. Augie sits on the couch, still looking dazed and distraught.
This is not what she wanted, he whispers. She would not want this.
Alex returns with a cup of water. I put out my hand. Give it to me, I say. I walk over to Augie and throw the water in his face, dousing his hair and shirt. He gasps in surprise, shakes his head, sits up straight. I lean down over him.
Are you being straight with me, kid?
There's a lot riding on you.
He
looks up at me, different from before, scared not just of the circumstances, but also of me. Alex, I say, show me the footage from the war room.
Yes, sir.
From his pocket, Alex removes his phone and clicks on it before handing it to me. It's the real-time feed from the security camera inside the war room, showing Casey on the phone, Devin on a computer, the other tech geniuses working on laptops and drawing on the whiteboard. Look at that, Augie. Are any of those people giving up? No. They're terrified, every one of them. But they're not giving up. Hell, you're the one who located the virus. You just did what my best people couldn't do for 2 weeks. He closes his eyes and nods.
I'm sorry.
I kick his shoes, jarring him. Look at me, Augie. Look at me. He does. Tell me about Nina. You said this isn't what she wanted. What do you mean? She didn't want to destroy America? Augie, eyes down, shakes his head.
Nina was tired of running. She said she'd been running for so long.
From the Georgian government?
Yes. Georgian intelligence had been chasing her. They almost killed her once in Uzbekistan.
Okay, well, so she was tired of running. What did she want? To live in America? My phone buzzes in my pocket. I pull it out. It's Liz Greenfield. I decline the call and stuff it back in my pocket.
She wanted to go home, says Augie.
To the Georgian Republic, where she's wanted for war crimes?
She was hoping you would assist her in that regard.
She wanted me to intervene. She wanted me to ask Georgia to grant her amnesty as a favor to the United States. Augie nods.
And would you not expect Georgia to do such a thing under the circumstances? If America was in peril and one of its allies, especially one that could use America as a friend, with the Russians on its border, do you not think Georgia would have granted you that favor?
They probably would have if I pressed hard enough. If I explained the situation thoroughly enough, yes, we would have figured something out. So I want to be sure I have this straight, I say. Nina helped Suleiman Jandoric build this virus.
Yes.
But she never wanted to destroy America with it. He pauses.
You must understand Sule, he says. The way he operates, Nina built a magnificent virus, a devastating stealth wiper virus. I worked, as you might say, on the other side of the business.
You were the hacker.
Yes. My job was to infiltrate American systems and spread the virus as far and wide as possible, but our positions were segregated, you would say.
I think I'm getting it now. She built a brilliant virus, but didn't know exactly to what use it would be put. And you spread the virus through American servers, but didn't know exactly what it was you were spreading.
What you're saying, yes.
He nods. He seems to be calming down now.
I do not mean to portray either of us as innocents. Nina knew the destructive nature of her virus, obviously, but she had no idea how far and wide it was going to be distributed. She did not know it was going to be spread throughout the United States to destroy the lives of hundreds of millions of people. And I...
He looks away.
Sully told me it was an advanced form of spyware I was disseminating, that he would sell it to the highest bidder to finance our other jobs. He shrugs. When we realized what we had done, we could not sit idly by.
So Nina came here to stop the virus, I say, in exchange for my help getting her amnesty. He nods again.
We hoped you would agree, but we couldn't predict your response. The Sons of Jihad had become responsible for the deaths of Americans in the past, and the United States is hardly what we would consider an ally, so she insisted on meeting you first alone.
To see how I would respond.
To see if you would let her leave the White House, as opposed to arresting her, torturing her, whatever else you might do.
That sounds right. It felt like a test at the time.
I objected to her going to the White House alone, he says, but she would not be deterred. By the time we met in the States, she clearly had a plan in mind.
Wait, I touch his arm. By the time you met in the States, what does that mean? You weren't together all along.
Oh, no, he says. No, no. The day we sent the peekaboo to your Pentagon server.
Saturday, April 28th. I'll never forget when I first heard about it. I was in Brussels on the first leg of my European trip. I got the call in the presidential suite. I'd never heard my defense secretary so rattled.
That was the day Nina and I left Suleiman in Algeria. We split up, though. We thought it was safer that way. She came to the United States through Canada. I came through Mexico. Our plan was to meet on Wednesday in Baltimore, Maryland.
Wednesday? This past Wednesday? 3 days ago?
Yes, Wednesday at noon by the statue of Edgar Allan Poe at the University of Baltimore. Close enough to Washington, but not too close. A logical place for people of our age to fit in, and a fixed point we both could find.
And that's when Nina told you the plan.
Yes. By then, she was certain that she had a plan in place. She would visit the White House on Friday night alone to test your reaction. Then you would meet me at the baseball stadium, another test, to see if you would even appear. And if you did, I would make my own judgment as to whether we could trust you. When you appeared at the stadium, I knew you had passed Nina's test.
And then I passed yours.
Yes, he says. If nothing else, the fact that I pulled a gun on the President of the United States and nobody immediately shot me or arrested me, I knew you believed us and would work with us.
I shake my head.
And then you contacted Nina? I texted her. She was waiting my signal to pull up to the stadium in her van.
How close we came, right there. Augie lets out a noise that sounds like laughter.
That was supposed to be the moment, he says, looking ruefully off in the distance. We would have all been together. I would have located the virus. You would have contacted the Georgian government, and she would have stopped the virus.
Instead, someone stopped Nina.
I will get back to work, Mr. President. He pushes himself off the couch. I am sorry for my momentary...
I push him back down. We're not done, Augie, I say. I want to know about Nina's source. I want to know about the traitor in the White House. Chapter 76. I remain hovering over Augie, all but shining a bright light in his face. You said by the time you met Nina in Baltimore 3 days ago, she was committed to a plan. He nods. Why? What happened between the time you split up in Algeria and the time you met up in Baltimore? What did she do? Where did she go?
This I do not know.
That doesn't wash, Augie.
I'm sorry, wash?
I lean in further still, nearly nose to nose with him. That doesn't ring true to me. You two loved each other. You trusted each other. You needed each other.
What we needed was to keep our information separate. he insists. For her own protection. She could not know how to locate the virus, and I could not know how to disarm it. This way we both remain of value to you.
What did she tell you about her source?
I have answered this question more than once.
Answer it again. I grab his shoulder and remember that the lives of hundreds of millions of people, she did not...